Hello and welcome to the Lib Dem podcast. My name is John Potter and I am hosting an episode today with two very special guests, both from the Trafford Lib Dems. This is Simon Lepore and Dr. Anna Fryer, who have both been key workers during the coronavirus crisis. And we wanted to get their experiences of what's happened, particularly, you know, regarding the mental health, and someone like Simon who came back to the NHS to actually, because of the virus. So firstly, I'd just like to welcome you both. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having us.
So Simon, obviously you weren't actually in the NHS until the crisis actually hit, and then you decided you've got to go back, and you shaved your beautiful beard and decided you want to try and help, don't you? So tell us about that decision, Simon. What happened to make you go back?
I think it was made a little easier for me, as some people don't know, I was the Trafford organiser from last September, and I saw us through the general election, and I was aiming for the local elections in May, something I left the NHS for originally. And then, as it all started ramping up, and we realised that local elections were going to get cancelled, and it was going to be a little bit harder for me to get paid. And it was a case of, I said to everyone, "Don't worry, I'm still on what we call the bank system from a local hospital. NHS Professionals is the NHS's agency." So it's not a private agency, it's run by the NHS. And I was still valid, and I said, "Don't worry, I can go work." And I phoned some managers and some old charge nurses that I used to work with, and they were happy to put me on a few shifts. And I was happy to go back. It was one of those moments where a little bit self-centered, a little bit ingratiating, but you do want to be able to say, "Oh, I'm a healthcare worker. Yes, I worked on the front line during the coronavirus crisis." And you don't want to be saying in a few years' time, "I did nothing." So
what has it been like on the front line, Anna? I mean, what have these last 3 months been like for you?
So, I mean, I have changed job during the crisis. So I was in a hospital in the Wirral, made famous by having a cohort from Wuhan right at the start of the crisis, which was an interesting challenge. And then I've moved locally to South Manchester Hospital. So it's been strange. I mean, I had the crossover about a week when I wasn't working, when it was very, very bad. It's been good to be back in my local community hospitals. But it's been like nothing we've ever seen in the NHS. I mean, I've been working in the NHS, I guess, now, student and doctor, about sort of 19 years or so, I guess. I'm trying to work this out. I can't, 17 years, something like that. too long. And, we've never seen the likes of it. We've had progressively terrible winters and bed crises and the like, but this has just been another level. And the aftermath, and I think one of the things people don't realise is that the aftermath now, we're in the lower numbers and we have to restart services, and the morbidity or the illness that will follow COVID, whether that be mental health, whether that be lung problems, a lot of lung follow-up is needed on some of these patients, I am worried about when the NHS concentrated on one thing. I think we did really well, I think we did well with the resource we had, which wasn't enough, but we did well. But it's going back to normal that's going to be hard, I think. Or facing a second wave when, healthcare workers are tired, we're exhausted.
Simon, going back into it, I mean, there's obviously the front line has been in everyone's minds, both politically about. So how have you found actually the front line going back? Have you had enough PPE? What has it been, just exhausting days that have just seemed to never end? What has been your experience?
Well, I went back at the beginning, the first 2 or 3 weeks, I was on day shifts, and I've moved on to night shifts. And what people need to understand is everywhere around the country has had their own peak point, their own flash point. So in Greater Manchester, our peak think, was over Easter weekend. And in the run up to that and in the week after, there was a high concentration of death. And there was deaths that weren't in ITU, that weren't in critical care settings, because the clinical decision had been made that it wasn't going to be worth their while to go onto a ventilator, or they wouldn't come off a ventilator safely afterwards. So a lot of the wards that I've worked on have had side rooms where a lot of these patients have been nursed. I moved onto a ward that was all COVID positive, medically fit patients. So they had higher respiratory rates and lower oxygen absorption, but they were all up and talking and alert. And there was a few points throughout those nights where someone would crash and someone would nosedive in terms of their physical sense. But they would always recover throughout the night through proper nursing and medical care. But it's watching colleagues I've known for years and watching new colleagues has been really interesting. Because some of the newer nurses and nursing assistants and nursing associates, watching them deal with it and watching the blind panic on their face has been kind of shocking. And it says a lot about how we don't prepare our student nurses and students for nursing in a crisis anymore. I mean, I got that training when I was training, and I was very unlucky that I was in London during 7/7 on a 3-month placement at St Guy's. So I saw all that. The riots in Manchester in 2011, another major incident point. I've seen all that, and of course the Manchester bombing in 2017. I was in the hospital during that, so I saw all that. It built my resilience. So even going back after 6 months off, I wasn't shocked at a moment by moment basis. Afterwards I broke down and cried, but Anna will testify to that. I think she received a phone call at something like 8 o'clock in the morning and I just started bawling down the phone. But that was after a quite horrific night for me. But I feel more for the younger nurses and younger members of staff that don't get the resilience training that they need.
Yeah. And Anna, you talked about, you know, the long-term effects of this. I mean, my dad was very ill with COVID and is recovering now, but it's taking a long time. I mean, what kind of effects should we be preparing for, both mentally and physically, from COVID? A lot of people are talking about the effect it's having on society as a whole, but actually from a very personal point of view, what should we be expecting over the next few weeks and months?
Well, we've got a data gap, you know, in terms of our forward planning. There is evidence coming out. There's been some recent cohort series that came out of over 100 patients. And in that study, what we found was a high incident of neuropsychiatric sequelae, i.e. things happening later on. And then a lot of those were due to strokes. And we know this illness can make your blood sticky so that you get PEs or pulmonary embolisms, clots within the lungs, but also the brain. So stroke services need a lot of, when done well, they improve outcomes fantastic, you know, in a massive way. So that's probably going to be one focus. It's such a complex question, really. I mean, we worried a little bit towards the start in the Royal College of Psychiatrists. We've been having neuropsychiatric reporting any kind of incidents. We know other coronaviruses, people can become psychotic at the most extreme end, manic. We know that the data coming out is showing a high, you know, increases in things like anxiety. And, you know, past predicts future to some extent. That's what psychiatrists say a lot. And so we've looked back at the SARS epidemic and the MERS, which are both coronaviruses. And we know after that there were high levels. The outcomes were studied for about 12 years afterwards, and they had high levels of PTSD, anxiety, all kinds of sort of psychiatric sequelae of that, which impacts the population. So I suppose if I was going to put money on it, there's two sides to this coin as well. So you talked about societal effects. We have seen more people coming in anxious, certainly, with very severe anxiety and something we call stress reactions, where people can become very unwell. We've seen less self-harm, which is really interesting. So self-harm coming in through A&E was down around about 50%. Now it's gone up rapidly this week, actually, but it dropped quite substantially. But then we know that there was lots going on in the community. You know, there was 400% plus increase in people looking at domestic abuse websites, for example. People are at home with children who have quite significant needs, maybe non sort of autism diagnosis, etc. So I guess I'm waffling a bit because it's such a big area. I could see there being a load of people with OCD symptoms that are worse. I could see people getting more anxious. I could see a tsunami coming at us of self-harm, because what traditionally happens in crisis is that you get through the crisis psychologically, but it's the aftermath, it's when the dust is settling. But there's another side to that as well, and the other sort of happier side is that we've seen communities come together, we've seen families reunited, we've seen perhaps people being supported at home who haven't perhaps been able to work, and being then surrounded by other people and have not felt as alone or isolated. And some of those people are doing better, you know. So there is a mixed bag here. But, you know, we're worried in mental health services, that, and I think it's true already, we went through a point with the virus around the peak, actually, where for the first time ever, mental health patients weren't being, you know, pooted around the country, sent all over the country, rather, because there was no beds in their local trust. That's very common. It's a massive problem for us. It's not good for the patients. They suffer because of it. They're not near family. They're not near local services. There isn't a link up. But it happens because we haven't got enough beds. Now, that wasn't happening at the turn of crisis. We had enough beds. That's not happened for years. What we're seeing now, unfortunately, is I know that we were hitting full capacity in the Northwest pretty recently. I'm not going to say which day. In there wasn't a bed in the region, you know. And what's the next when it's, and that's happened really rapidly. So what are we going to get to next? There'll be no beds in the country. It's happened before, mental health beds, that is. So it's a worry.
I will add on to that, John.
Yeah,
in terms of beds, mental health beds are now filling up, but normal hospital beds are remaining empty. You know, there, I mean, there is a certain hospital that still has 200 empty acute beds, because they're bringing people in, but then getting them discharged quicker because they're not overloaded as they were before. And that's something that's going to have to be looked at. The link between hospitals and local councils in terms of social care, and how we move people through the system, and the speed at which we move people through the system, and the safety level at which we move people through the system, that's something that is going to come out of this, because a lot of people are saying we managed to empty a hospital in the space of 2 weeks at the beginning of this pandemic. How did we do that?
But at what cost, Simon?
That was a question on everyone's lip. But at what cost? Yeah.
You know, the excess mortality is clearly higher. We know that it's dramatically higher. And I'd argue that there was a lot of unsafe discharge. Yeah. I'm sure you would as well.
Yeah. And I think the studies coming from, my council area is you see the care home deaths with people. And this will be one of the scandals that comes out of this whole crisis, is people being sent back to care homes without having been tested. But do you think, and this is, do you think we have over concentrated on the NHS and ignored the care sector in dealing with this crisis?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I do some mental health back work as well, so I regularly go to care homes and across Greater Manchester, really, more often in South Manchester. And we've had 66 deaths in Trafford alone in care home settings, which is an astonishingly high figure. And that doesn't even count the excess mortality. It's just COVID-positive patients. So it's a high number. And I think that at the start of a crisis, you know, we know that we weren't protecting those care homes. They found it very hard to source PPE, for example. Some of the care homes I went in, they had PPE available. Some didn't. I started carrying my own really early on after the experience in the Wirral where we'd seen COVID quite early on. And it was very variable and the guidance wasn't great. It often went down to sort of individual leadership and management locally. And in terms of, you know, but it was such a crisis, you know, lots of people in whose staffing were getting sick. People who do home visits were getting sick. And, you know, it was just horrendous. And social care wasn't protected in the way the NHS was, I don't think. I don't know if you agree, Simon.
Oh, no, absolutely. But I think social care, since it was, and this is a bit controversial, since it's been, along with public health and social care, pushed onto local councils in the 80s, late 70s, mid 80s, somewhere around then it was, it's been a downward spiral. Whereas the amount of people needing those services have been on an upward trajectory. And, you know, changing the name of the Department of Health to Health and Social Care, unless you're actually going to do anything about it, and start uniforming how places are made to work and actually give the Care Quality Commission teeth to deal with care homes and deal with care providers. Because 9 times out of 10, it's not necessarily the care home, it's actually their big masters that own 20 care homes that are denying them things to provide the care. It's one of those issues that is going to run over the next 20 years of people that are now in their 60s that are going to need care as the baby boom generation lives longer than anyone thought they would. It's still going to be there and local councils are still going to struggle. They're being cut back to the bone and they don't necessarily have the powers they need to constantly monitor and enforce rules in local care homes that need to be enforced. Part of that is funding, but a lot of that is powers and guidance. You walk into a council with councillors and council officers and you say, why hasn't this been done? And they're like, oh, do we have to do that? And I went, yeah, you do. Come on. And that's come up during this virus because, oh, actually, we do have authority to deal with that and do that, sing that issue. But we've never had to do it before, so we never thought we had to. And that's sprung up over the country.
And I wonder
I think the other thing that's been really kind of wonderful and kind of shocking is the amount of support we've had from the community, as social care workers, as NHS workers, you know, being at your local takeaway, giving you a bit of a discount, people clapping every week, of course. And care workers are wearing that cohort. I think we're seeing their value. And I think that's maybe another positive we're seeing from this crisis. You know, these are people who I don't think are paid enough. I think they do extremely skilled jobs. I think that they have a lack of a structure in terms of their own development and management, which is not something. So in the NHS, you will have CPD, you'll be educated, that'll be part of your role. It's a right within your role and your contract. You might be funded to do certain courses or certificates, diplomas, etc., and developed, you know, as a worker. And, you know, the social care workforce needs to do that now. It's quite clear that British people really value social care workers, are very grateful to them, and I would like us to see that followed up with something very solid.
Do you not find, Anna, that the pay disparity is something that's quite shocking? Because social care workers aren't on the NHS Agenda for Change pay scale.
Absolutely.
They are, a lot of them are paid minimum wage or national living wage. In these care homes, one of the things that we should be advocating for as a party, I would say, is actually, okay, so care can't afford a rolling scale of Agenda for Change. Let's create a national social care pay scale that nursing homes and care homes and social care home carers have to adhere to. That isn't just minimum wage. But then you could talk about all key workers. And one of the things I think I would ask our party to call for right now is, say, a 3 or 4% increase in the national minimum wage right now. Let's do it now, because these people have kept this country afloat for the past 3 months, 4 months in some cases. You know, that they need to be rewarded and need to be recognised. And these are people that have worked in food warehouses, supermarkets that are on minimum wage.
Food industries, absolutely.
And I want to just kind of come in, because it's very interesting, because at the time of recording this, I do wonder if two of the consequences from this might be quite profound in terms of what Liberal Democrats have always campaigned for. I don't know if you actually saw a paper that I would never advocate for being particularly liberal or progressive, but the Daily Express today had a penny for social care as its headline on the front of it. Something the Lib Dems have been going on about for ages, a penny for social care. And I nearly fell off my seat when I saw the Daily Express headline. But also, going back to what you said, Anna, about appreciation of this. I mean, I have been very pro-immigration all my life. The benefits of it, and we've seen in the terms of it. Now, that isn't in the Daily Express. You won't be surprised. But actually, if there was ever going to be a crisis that would highlight the importance of immigration into this country, it has been this crisis. They are the care workers, the fruit pickers. And what you were saying, Anna, about people appreciating, the public appreciating what these people have done to keep our country going, that might be a seismic shift towards something very positive and very progressive in our country. I mean, do you guys agree?
I guess I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
I'll say the opposite. I think that, yes, but Ben, that you will have an extreme edge, which will be that, sadly, that COVID was brought in by foreigners, everybody coming in on planes, you know, and I've heard that one before, I'm afraid, in a sort of anti-immigration rhetoric. And so there is that as well, it almost could go both ways.
Yeah. I suppose, Simon, as an organiser, your local party, our job is, you know, one of the failings we had probably over on Europe for the last few decades is not showing off the value that Europe brings
and I would say that's an issue with this talking about immigrants that are working in our frontline services, whether they're second, third, or fourth generation, you know, British Indians or Afro-Caribbeans working in our fire service, in our social care sector, with our police, in our healthcare sector, and the nurses and doctors that have been brought and hired over the past 2 years to work in our NHS. I mean, most of the shifts that I do are with immigrant Indian nurses.
I mean, that's a brilliant idea about the pay scale. I love that idea. But what does the government have to do right now? What do you think is the most critical thing? Is it getting the tracking and tracing app and data ready to go? Because at the moment, despite what they're saying, we know from a local authority that we're weeks away from it being right. So what's next for you?
I mean, the track and trace is a complete debacle, because Google and Apple and all those have actually got them. We may not agree with those two big worldwide companies, you know, but they had a system in place that the government refused to sign up to. the government refused to get involved with. That has slowed down track and trace in this country. It needs to be rolled out. It needs to be brought forward. And I think Question Time today has just shown that and highlighted it even more. But I would say one of the things that government can do to show appreciation and to back up all of the key workers that are on minimum wage is say, right, you will all get from backdated from the 1st of April a hike in your minimum wage payments.
So the COVID crisis has been so unique. It's not just about us going to work and getting stuck in. It's everything that's outside your life, isn't it? But your support networks, your the grandparents, the aunties, the uncles, you know, is gone and things have changed a lot. But anyway, we're talking about social care and, yeah, I mean, I very much agree with Simon about us recognising and moving to that model. But I may have slightly lost my train of thought there. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Trust me. If you've ever listened to my podcast, it happens all the time. but it's kind of an interesting one for what you were saying, Simon, about making sure we get the track and trace right. Because one of the things we are, again, an outlier as a country is that we're having a centralized approach. You know, Germany started off with a centralized approach and then went to local hubs. I just had a briefing today from Lancashire County Council saying, you know, the county's desperate for data. So, because what's going to happen is any secondary peaks or little spikes are going to be localized. And so you're going to need a localized response. Do you see, I mean, again, play devil's advocate with me if you want, but are there any particular virtues to a nationalized system compared to a localized system that the rest of the world is doing?
I think we should have local databases. And I think it should feed into that national, but it should be monitored and developed and fed into locally. So local councils and local healthcare can actually all adapt their services accordingly. One of the things I think, again, another highlight of this is actually the electoral deficit, the democratic deficit in England, where you've got Greater London that doesn't have devolved healthcare powers, that had to wait for government to tell hospitals what to do in Greater London. Whereas you've got places like Greater Manchester that have devolved healthcare and were able to actually work across the trusts, across Greater Manchester, to actually develop an action plan to fight and to make sure staffing levels were appropriate. And I think across the north, we were always going to be a delayed infectant of it. But because we didn't have a northern parliament or a northern response, it halted. But we still got spikes in places like Manchester, in places like Cumbria, for heaven's sake.
Cumbria.
You know, a rural place having a huge increase. Speaking
from my point of view, Preston was just listed as one of the places that has yet to hit its spike. Again, briefing today by Director of Public Health for Lancashire just told me that the R rate is verging on one. We are so close in Lancashire to the disease accelerating that I get that the economy can't be in lockdown forever, but until a track and trace system is on board, surely we're just risking greater damage both economically and society and health wise going forward.
Having come so far as well, I've gone through all this pain of lockdown and it has been terribly difficult for so many people. I don't want us to have to go into another 3-month lockdown. I would have liked us to stay. I think we're 2 weeks too early, frankly, you know, in terms of lifting the restrictions. And I think it was politically motivated, to be honest. I also think that people lost faith in politicians because of Dominic Cummings and the farce of what happened and transpired with his trip up north. So, you know, it was really poor timing. And I think it's going to have less of an impact in London, as you say, because London had a peak a long time ago. Their R rate is lower. They have gone through more cases, but they've had a really awful time. Whereas in a lot of places in the north, like the northeast as well, you know, we're having, yes, it's coming down, but it's coming down slowly. We're also coming out at a point where other European countries didn't, and that worries me greatly. I don't want to be doom and gloom, and I accept that there has been harm caused by the lockdown as well, not least things like jobs and security, but also isolation, loneliness, anxiety, depression, all these, people have lost their coping skills, for example, or things, being restricted. We don't like restriction in the Lib Dems, do we, all liberals? No. But it feels too soon.
And one thing that not everyone appreciates now, because lockdown has changed our life so much, is that Britain didn't lock down as fiercely as some European countries as well. Lockdown was hard for everyone, but actually the scale of the lockdown in Britain was a lot less than some of our European counterparts. But I've only got a couple of minutes left. So I suppose I want you guys now, what's your advice to listeners and viewers at the moment? Anna, I want to go to you about mental health, because I don't know about some days during this lockdown, I have felt utterly rotten. And what you're saying about anxiety, I will wake up just feeling anxious about everything. What should people do? Is it go to places like Mind and find information out that can help you? What do you reckon?
Well, we cover quite a lot of regions with this podcast, don't we? So I guess if you look at your local mental health trust, for example, I shouldn't say who I work for, actually. A mental health trust. Go to your local mental health trust. You Google it. And perhaps look at any resources they have there. So I know we on our websites and across the country there will be. So there may be phone counselling services. There may be phone lines you can ring. There's the national phone lines, places like Samaritans. There's phone lines from Mind. And then maybe thinking about, some things which, very basic kind of self-soothing and distraction techniques as well are things that we do. Connecting to people is really important. Connecting to people on social media. But I'll have a caveat for that. I've just said I think we came out of lockdown too soon, and I've appealed to people to, I am desperate to see my family. I have a twin sister, she lives in Watford. We haven't seen her since lockdown started. She normally comes every few weeks, desperate to see her, but I wouldn't dream of seeing her, let's crack on a few more weeks. Let's keep being good. Be really careful. I think that as we have seen across the region, a few drinks and a group of people in a park, and I think 2 meters goes out the window. I don't think we mean to. I think it's often really, it's that pent up frustration. So kind of dig deep and carry on a bit, really.
Final word from you, Simon, to finish us off.
In general, I think, stay the course. I'll repeat everything that Anna's just said. Wash your hands properly. Mm-hmm. Stop wearing gloves to go shopping with.
Stop.
But yeah, wear a mask, wash your hands, take some alcohol with you, and go stand at the end of drives and say hello to your neighbours, but don't get any closer. And let's just do it for another few more weeks. A few more weeks. Let's just see it ride out a little bit longer.
And if you're feeling stressed, pick up your phone, speak to your friends, speak to your family. If you speak to Samaritans or anybody like that, if you just need somebody, try and do activities. Take up a hobby, colouring, mindful kind of activities as well. And I think that we're saying this not because we're kind of killjoys, we're a bit killjoy, but 2 weeks of this, I think we need to, 2 more weeks of being quite strict, and then we can think about a little bit of loosening and how we're getting on, but just keep going.
Right. Well, all I can do is, because we've literally only got like a minute or so left, is thank you both so much for being on the podcast. Thank you to all our listeners and viewers for checking out this episode. Do go follow Simon and Anna on their social media. They are always worth listening to. Do follow everything to do with the Lib Dem podcast at Lib Dem Pod on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. And also make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. Once again, thank you so much to these two. And just repeat that message to all our listeners. Stay safe. Be sensible, wash your hands, and we will get through this. Thank you very much.